This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. What a difference a week makes. Remember last Sunday? Damp, chilly. And here we are feeling like summertime today. I'm glad to have your company this afternoon, and I hope you stay tuned. In the next half hour, we'll have Emily Richardson Lorente's excellent in-depth reports on why so few kids in Virginia are getting the HPV vaccine, even though it safely prevents not only the human papillomavirus, but also some cancers later on in adulthood. We'll also have a discussion of the past week in Virginia politics coming up. But first, of all places, a church in Stanton was the site of the 7th annual Virginia Liars Contest last weekend. Weavers of Whoppers had 8 minutes to spin fantastical fibs for a crowd. The best tall tale won $100, a golden shovel, and a bag of manure. WMRA's Jesse Nadler was there to take it all in and learn more about the fine art of storytelling.
At the 7th annual Liars Contest in Stanton over the weekend, Ben Yoder of Stewart's Draft stood before a crowd of about 70, mostly more mature adults, and told the story about once having to clear out the contents of a spooky house for auction.
For over 25 years, I have chosen auctions as my primary source of income.
The germ of competitors' stories, there were 7 competitors in all, is supposed to be rooted in truth. But it's a liar's contest, so you're expected to embellish details. In Yoder's story, that probably was the bit about encountering a levitating coffin in the basement of the spooky house. The coffin, he said, chased him throughout the house and into the bathroom, where Yoder grabbed a bottle off the counter and threw it.
Finally, when I gathered the nerve, I stepped up towards the coffin, and then I saw it. The bottle was a bottle of NyQuil, and right on the side of the bottle, it said, "It stops the coffin."
Why compete for storytelling? Well, when you think about it, telling a good story that holds the audience's attention for 8 full minutes is no easy feat. You've got to think about plot, pacing, vocal inflection, suspense, humor. Think about all the times you've listened to stories that made your eyes glaze over, while a more gifted teller would have you on the edge of your seat. Good storytelling is a craft, an art. It's 8 minutes of theater. Here's competition organizer Joan Swift.
It's like a book. You have to prepare and you have to edit.
Swift is a member of the Virginia Storytelling Alliance, which co-sponsored the event. They hold storytelling events throughout the state.
Storytelling has its own little following. It's been around since the beginning of time. A fairy tale, for instance. I mean, why have fairy tales been told all these years?
It's because, she says, they have strong storylines. Lisa Thompson of Salem told a tale about encountering shotgun-carrying hooligans in the mountains.
Uh-oh. Somebody said something that somebody didn't like. They're going to have a fight out there. I can hear it a-brewing.
Thompson says she didn't start storytelling until the age of 50.
And I pull from reality of my life, and I always find at the end of my thoughts, there's always a twist in the learning of the lesson in which I was speaking.
Charlie Statzer, an engineer from Floyd County, spent 2 months writing and refining his tall tale about a poor boy who became the first millionaire of Franklin County.
Now, when Snuffy graduated from sixth grade, he was 18 years old.
To get into character, Statzer wore a bib overalls and laid on a thick accent.
Plus, taking a teeth out helps a lot, too.
Yeah, he removed his false teeth for his performance. Hey, whatever it takes to get into character.
To me, I felt relationship with the audience and things just started flowing. That's the difference between a good speaker and somebody that's not a good speaker. If they fear the audience, they're not going to be a good speaker.
Virginia Storytelling Alliance president Gail Turner was one of 4 judges. After all 7 stories had concluded, the judges convened to another room to evaluate the tales by audience engagement, structure, wit, and brevity. Turner is really into storytelling.
Oh my God, it's the currency of humanity.
The judges' conclusion? Charlie Statzer and his bib overalls took 2nd place. And 1st place? That went to Ben Yoder for his Stop the Coffin NyQuil Whopper. That lucky liar, he walked away with $100, a golden shovel, and a big bag of manure.
Being an auctioneer has helped me a lot with relating to audiences, getting feedback from audiences, watching their reaction, and then playing off of those reactions.
The Virginia Storytelling Alliance plans to have another event sometime in August. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Now to the big health report of the week. Infections from the human papillomavirus, or HPV, are leading to an increasing number of cancers in both men and women. There's a vaccine that can prevent it, but most people in Virginia aren't getting the vaccine. In fact, compliance rates for HPV vaccination are so low here and throughout the U.S. that health officials call it a serious public health threat. WMRA's Emily Richardson Lorente did lots of research, and here is her first report.
HPV, the human papillomavirus, is a wickedly common sexually transmitted virus. More than 4 out of 5 of us will be infected with it at some point, most without ever knowing it or showing any symptoms. But for an increasing number of Americans, about 31,500 each year, a lingering HPV infection will eventually lead to cancer. And not just any cancer. The cringe-inducing cancers, cervical, vaginal, penile, anal, plus increasingly, cancers in the throat, transmitted through oral sex. The good news is that there is a childhood vaccine that's remarkably effective in preventing these cancers in adulthood. The bad news is that lots of kids aren't getting it.
It's incredibly easy to opt out.
That's Jessica Keim-Malpass, an oncology nurse and assistant professor of nursing at the University of Virginia. She's been studying HPV vaccination compliance in the state for a few years now.
I became really interested in this vaccine and this issue in particular because we have been doing just a very poor job of getting our kids vaccinated.
Virginia was actually ahead of the curve when the HPV vaccine was released in 2006. We were, in fact, the first state to make the 3-shot vaccine mandatory for 6th-grade girls. But in the decades since then, our vaccination rate has fallen behind 31 other states. As of 2015, only about 1/3 of Virginia kids were getting fully vaccinated by age 18.
Many people say, what good is having a mandate when it's essentially so easy to get out of it? Does it even really do its job?
In fact, state law says parents can opt out at their sole discretion, no paperwork required. But why do so many parents opt out? Keim-Malpass says some parents are just uncomfortable with the idea of vaccinating their little girl or boy against HPV.
Parents assumed that because this vaccine is targeted to HPV, which is in fact a sexually transmitted infection, it may promote sexual debut.
Sexual debut may not be a term you or I have ever used, but you get what she's saying, right? It's spooky to think about this stuff with your 11-year-old. But research has shown that vaccination does not lead to early sexual debut.
The whole reason that the vaccine works is that we are targeting boys and girls before they have sexual encounters, and we know that it works better when we get them at that young age.
In fact, children ages 11 to 14 react so well to the vaccine that the CDC recently reduced the number of shots required at those ages from 3 to just 2. Of course, for some parents, the number of shots is a moot point, because they just don't trust vaccines, to which Keim-Malpass says,
now that the vaccine has been out for 10 years, we know that it's really effective at preventing devastating cancers, and we know that it's safe.
Vaccine skepticism and parental squeamishness may not be easy obstacles to overcome, but Keim-Malpass identified one change that could make a big difference. The doctor's delivery.
If the provider has hesitation about the recommendation, then we know that that leads to hesitation on the parent end as well.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm fine.
That's Charlottesville pediatrician Emily Wong.
We have found in our own office that when we gave a better recommendation, there was a lot better uptake of the vaccine than we had expected.
A year ago, Dr. Wong and her colleagues realized they were presenting the Tdap and meningococcal vaccines as mandatory to parents of 6th graders, and the HPV vaccine as effectively optional, because after all, skipping the vaccine wouldn't bar their kids from school.
And when we presented it like that, well, no one would choose the optional vaccine. And when we think about what we're trying to prevent, I think that's the most important thing, that we recognize we're trying to prevent cancer. And there are very few things that we have to prevent cancer.
Initially, the CDC recommended the HPV vaccine only for girls, primarily to prevent cervical cancer, which kills about 4,200 women a year in the U.S. boys weren't added to the CDC's recommendation until 5 years later.
In the beginning, they thought, oh, we're just vaccinating the boys because we're trying to protect the girls. But now that we realize there is a growing number of oropharyngeal cancer in males.
Those are cancers in the throat, at the base of the tongue or the tonsil.
Parents of boys have become more receptive as well.
And you trust the HPV vaccine?
Yes, I've had it administered to my own child. All right, Madeline. Well, it's been 15 minutes since your shot. How are you feeling?
I feel all right.
Okay, great. Well, you're free to go then. And just remember that you need to have a second shot after 6 months. All right?
All right.
If every child received their HPV vaccination on schedule, that could prevent up to 90% of HPV-related cancers down the road, according to the American Cancer Society. That's an awful lot of adults who won't get cancer and won't have to wonder if a childhood vaccine could have prevented it.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We've known for a long time that the human papillomavirus can cause cervical cancer in women, but increasingly HPV is causing cancers further up the body and the throats of people infected with the virus. And the largest group of patients? Middle-aged men. In her second report, Emily has the story of one Virginia man dealing with the consequences.
54-year-old Keith Hart is a hunter. Bobcats, wild turkeys, deer, whatever he can track in the woods around his house in eastern Virginia. His wife, Lori, says he's not just a country boy. He's a man's man.
Yeah, he is a man's man.
Before Keith got sick at 52,
you got that right.
He kind of thought of himself that way, too.
Took care of everything and then come home and could take care of everything around the house. Go and go and go every day. Good hard work. Just steady. And then now I'm like a little old man trying to play catch up.
So what happened to Keith? HPV did. Or rather, an oropharyngeal cancer caused by HPV.
On the front side of my neck, I found a lump. I figured I better get it checked out.
After a biopsy, Keith's doctor gave him the diagnosis, base of tongue cancer, stage 4.
I could tell he felt bad for me, and that kind of scared me.
The doctor then referred Keith to Mark Jamison, a head and neck surgeon at the University of Virginia. 15 years ago, most of the cancer patients his department treated were heavy smokers or drinkers in their 60s or 70s. Now the patients are younger, often otherwise healthy, and their cancers are far more likely to be caused by the sexually transmitted human papillomavirus.
Of the cancers of the tonsil and tongue base that we deal with now, close to 80% of those cancers are HPV-related. And while they have a reasonably good prognosis, people go through hell and high water to get treated.
Keith certainly did. After having 42 lymph nodes and a chunk of his tongue removed, he began radiation.
Which once they got started was every day for 37 days.
It wasn't until after the surgery that Keith learned definitively that his cancer was caused by HPV, most likely transmitted through oral sex, which hit his wife Lori particularly hard.
Because I thought, my God, did I just kill my husband? Did I just give him cancer? I blame myself. I thought I gave it to him. I felt horrible.
Lori had had an HPV infection in her 20s, but that's not unusual. In fact, the human papillomavirus is so common that more than 80% of us will eventually become infected with it. Some women will end up with an irregular pap smear like Lori did. Other people will end up with genital warts. But most will clear an HPV infection without ever knowing they had it, who they got it from, or who they might have given it to. But in a fraction of people, like Keith, an old HPV infection will eventually become cancer.
I'm only 50% of what I used to be, basically. Physically, I'm only 50%.
18 months after his treatment, Keith is still recovering.
You know, I walk out some days and I think that nothing's wrong with me, and I start trying to use my body like I used to, and then the next day I suffer for a week or 2 weeks. So one day you feel good, and then you pay for it.
Lingering pain from the surgery and radiation is a big problem. But one thing that really galls Keith is something much more banal. Food tasted terrible.
Nasty. You'd get all types of metal tastes in your mouth, kind of like putting a penny in your mouth.
Keith's sense of taste is returning slower than he hoped it would, but he'll take what he can get.
2 bites of corn, 2 bites of lettuce, 2 bites of anything is great nowadays. But after that, it starts to go bad.
And as if that wasn't enough to deal with, there's the dry mouth. Keith's salivary glands just don't work like they used to.
My best friend is the mouth spray to keep my mouth moist and keep me swallowing. It's really been antagonizing to fight this dry mouth.
The good news is, of course, that Keith's cancer is in remission, and he'll continue to feel better with time. But Dr. Jameson says,
I mean, we may have a great survival rate, but we still have folks that die from this disease. And, you know, I think the take-home point is, ultimately, it's unnecessary.
Unnecessary because there's a vaccine to prevent just these types of sexually transmitted cancers. It is, however, a childhood vaccine. And here in Virginia, only about 1 in 3 kids completes their shots by age 18. Given what Keith has been through, it's no surprise that he and his wife Lori jumped on the chance to get their 13-year-old daughter vaccinated.
I went and got her that vaccination right away. Right away.
I don't want her to get anything from anybody, and I don't want her to get something and give it to somebody. I definitely don't want anybody to follow in my footsteps.
Although the Centers for Disease Control recommends routine HPV vaccination at age 11 or 12, the vaccine can be used for women up to age 26 and men up to age 21. So if you're in that age range or love someone who is, it's worth noting that the HPV vaccine won't just prevent them from getting a potentially embarrassing sexually transmitted infection, but may actually save them from a sexually transmitted cancer way down the road. For WMRA News, I'm Emily Richardson Lorente.
Let's turn our attention to state politics now. Craig Carper with our partner station WCVE in Richmond sat down with Jeff Shapiro, political columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, for some analysis of the past week in politics.
Jeff, an early warning alarm from one of the big three credit rating agencies could put the kibosh on tax cuts and expanded spending by Democratic and Republican candidates for governor.
The McAuliffe administration very quietly told the legislature about a week ago that Standard & Poor's, one of those agencies, while affirming Virginia's AAA credit rating, that's the highest possible credit rating, is nonetheless bearish on the state's economy. And the agency's economic outlook is going to shift from stable to negative. S&P is worried about a couple of things. One, that big drawdown, about $600 million by the legislature and McAuliffe from the rainy day fund to soften the landing, if you will, following that $1.5 billion hole that emerged in the budget, largely because of those across-the-board spending cuts that erased a lot of high-dollar jobs and the taxes they generate. This brings us to that second concern of Standard & Poor's, and that is what's going to happen with federal spending during the Trump era. Trump talks a lot about significantly increasing defense spending. That would probably be good for Virginia, but it would also reinforce Virginia's dependence on federal largesse, an issue of concern to Democrats and Republicans, all of whom talk about the need to diversify the state's economy. This means that Ed Gillespie and Corey Stewart, who want to cut or eliminate the income tax, might have to forget about it. Ralph Northam, the Democrat, wants to do away with the sales tax on groceries. Maybe forget about that. Tom Perriello, a Democrat running for governor as well, he's talking about more than $1 billion in new spending that includes free community college. And he says that should be paid for. He's certainly suggesting that it should be paid for by higher taxes on business. Interestingly enough, Frank Wagner, the third Republican candidate, is very concerned about all of this tax cutting and increased spending, and he represents himself as the only real adult in this campaign. He's running on a proposal to increase transportation taxes and finally, he hopes, stabilize the state's highway financing fund.
Jeff, it's springtime, and campaign ads are beginning to appear on the airwaves.
Yes, one in particular, Ralph Northam. He is the first out with an ad in this primary season. He's got the cash to do it, at $3 million already socked away, and that's about three times what his rival, Mr. Perriello, has. This ad that Northam is running hits all the buttons for Democratic primary voters. It talks about health care, gay rights, abortion rights, gun control, and Donald Trump. If there's an issue or an individual that really unifies Democrats, it's certainly the president. And I think this indicates that this ad is somewhat national in tone, and that's a reflection of our increasingly national state politics. But the ad also underscores Northam's Virginia bona fides. That's a contrast with Perriello, who's running this insurgent campaign, and it tends to gloss over his inexperience in state politics. Another way he does that, this hole in his resume, if you catch my meaning, is by playing up his national endorsements. And the latest this week from Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator and tormentor of Wall Street.
Governor Terry McAuliffe boasting about another record he's set, this one for the most rights restored to former felons of any governor in American history.
The source of the governor's claim was not entirely clear when this statement was made. The administration says that McAuliffe has surpassed a mark set by Governor Charlie Crist of Florida, the former Florida governor. 151,000 felons had their rights restored by Florida's clemency board. It is a boast that perhaps will mobilize prospective voters. Remember, these felons still have to register to vote, but it will also energize liberal and minority voters for whom rights restoration can be a very big deal. And remember, of course, McAuliffe and the Republicans in the legislature, a battle before the Supreme Court over the governor's attempt to restore en masse the rights of 206,000 felons. The Republicans prevailed. And the court said that the governor can do this. His power is absolute, but he can only do it on a case-by-case basis.
And, Jeff, we've spoken about the war for endorsements in the gubernatorial race. There's another fight for endorsements brewing in Northern Virginia for a congressional seat.
Yes, and this has to do in part with the interest of Dorothy McAuliffe, the First Lady, in the congressional seat in Northern Virginia now held by Republican Barbara Comstock. She's that survivor who held her seat, winning a second term, even though her district, Virginia 10, comfortably fell to Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. Now, the early front runner for the Democratic nomination is a state senator from Loudoun. Her name is Jennifer Wexton. There are about five candidates running currently. A McAuliffe-Comstock face-off, I suspect, would revive those Clinton wars, maybe writ small. It's an opportunity for Comstock, who made her living for a while digging up dirt on the Clintons, to heap some of that on one of the Clintons' best friends, Dorothy McAuliffe.
Thanks to Jeff Shapiro, political columnist at the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Jeff, until next time.
Have a wonderful weekend.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news. Then click on News and Information Fund. All of our stories from the newsroom are at WMRA.org, and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio, and follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.